You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia.
Good afternoon. This is Commander Tom Garcia, and this is the American Hour on the USA Talk Radio Network. And I have with me my lovely co-host, Paula Lausanne Ostman. How are you doing today, Paula?
Doing great, Tom. How are you?
Good. Well, I want to let everybody know that I am broadcasting live from Sao Paulo, Brazil, in the luxurious Grand Pullman Hotel. It was a beautiful day down here. Went out for a little walk this afternoon, and it appears it's a holiday, and I meant to look it up. Maybe if you can do that while we're talking here, Paula.
Sure.
It's got to be a holiday. We're near a pretty major intersection here, and it's really been quiet, especially people out walking around, and a lot of the stores and shops are closed. So apparently some kind of a holiday here, and interesting
it
that it's on a Thursday. I wonder...
It might have something to do with Holy Thursday, Tom.
That may be it. I'm not a Catholic, and so I had a feeling it might be some kind of a religious holiday, because I think I would have known if there was some major holiday, it was going to be a big four-day weekend here. I bet they're back to work as normal tomorrow. But
tomorrow,
in any case,
It's Holy Week, so it leads right up to Easter on Sunday.
Yeah. There you go. Well, it's certainly, I know that, I've got some Jewish friends, and Passover was very big this week for them. But I know that if I were back home in Florida, you wouldn't notice a thing today. It would look just like business as usual. But in any case, so I got to tell you about something, Paul. I went out this afternoon just to walk around and get some fresh air, and I had bought enough food at the grocery store yesterday that I didn't really need to go somewhere to eat. But I did need one thing. I could have used another piece of bread because I had some brie cheese, and I like eating that with like a French bread. So as I was out walking around, I found what we call in Spanish a panaderia, which was open, and I can't remember what they call it here in Portuguese, but the name of the store
padaria.
Was Flor. Say it again.
A padaria.
Yeah, that sounds about right. The name of the place is Flor do Paraíso, and it's open 24 hours, too. I noticed that on the sign it says aberto 24 horas, which is pretty close to Spanish. So I do okay around here getting around. But
you.
I went in there, and they were serving lunch to people, and there were some people in there. But they also had a big, a bread store, what do you call it, a bakery, kind of a bakery section. And it was pretty dead over in that section. So I went over to the restaurant section and asked, is there somebody working over here? And they sent somebody out. And I said, I just need one piece. I just needed enough. I still had some bread left over. But this thing was to die for. I mean, French bread's okay and that kind of thing. But, it was so fresh and light and delicious. I will be going back there. It was unbelievable. I don't think I've ever had a piece of French bread that tasted that good. And here's the interesting thing. It was just all sitting out. But it's so humid here right now, and it's warm out, that they put it in a bag. I walked back to the hotel. When I opened it up, it felt like it had just come out of the oven. But there's no way it had just come out of the oven. It was clearly just sitting out there on a shelf, But the pastries and things they had there looked so good. Boy, it was very tempting. I had to really hold myself back to not buy some of the nice pastries that they had. But the bread, my gosh, that was so worth it. I could imagine doing all kinds of things with that bread, between soup and making a sandwich or, it was very good with the cheese.
Have you tried the cheeses down there?
Tried the what now? Say that again.
Portuguese cheeses. Have you tried the Brazilian Portuguese cheeses?
I haven't, because I don't know what they are, and they have so many different cheeses that I'm just afraid to try something not knowing what it is. But you know what I'll do? We typically have lots of flight attendants that not only speak Portuguese, but they're from Brazil. So I'll ask them to explain that to me, and I'll be back tonight. So, in case anybody just joined us, I'm broadcasting from Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Paula's broadcasting from Boston, Massachusetts area. If at some point I have some trouble with my broadcasting, you'll know that's what it is, because I'm 4,000 miles away, and I also don't hear as well as you're hearing me. It seems always in the past and even today that my broadcasting is just fine, that you should hear it fine, but sometimes I don't hear the guests as well. It breaks up a little bit. So just bear with us. Be back in Florida tomorrow, then everything be A-okay, and we've got a fantastic guest tomorrow. It's Winston Scott. He's a retired Navy captain, and he was a shuttle astronaut. He still lives in the Space Coast, and we are going to be talking about NASA, and more NASA tomorrow. If you have any interest in NASA whatsoever, please listen in and call in. And Winston, I know can answer your questions. I know a little bit about NASA myself, and he's also a fighter pilot in the Navy, as I was, so we have a lot in common, and I've known him for a few years now. 4 o'clock tomorrow, and I think it's very ironic, and I didn't plan it this way. It was really just trying to get Winston on the radio when we could, but tomorrow's Earth Day, so to have an astronaut on Earth Day I think is very cool. So I'm looking forward to that. So please don't miss that show. And if for some reason people aren't able to listen in tomorrow or call in, they can always stream it after the fact or download it from usatalkradionetwork.com. And, of course, they can always follow us on Facebook at the American Hour Radio Show page. And then there's Twitter, the American Hour. And, of course, you're on Twitter, Paula, at Megawatt Queen. So there's lots of places people can find out what's going on with the show and going on with us. And as I said, big day tomorrow. And then on Monday, Kathleen McKinley. And let me tell you a little bit about Kathleen. I'm going to pull her information up. She's a political blogger and writer. I'm just going to read to you from her website. It's KathleenMcKinley.com. Let's see. She says, I'm a political junkie, a volunteer, and an activist. Sounds like a lot of us. And we got Dick Birnbach on the phone here. We're going to bring him on in a minute. And that's pretty much what Dick is. He's a political junkie, volunteer, and activist. I know that. I've seen him in action. And he did a lot to help me on my congressional campaign. She says, I write for Texas Magazine, print and online, Newsbusters, Right Wing News, and the Houston Chronicle. And then she does her own radio show every Tuesday night. It's called Smart Girl Nation, every Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. Eastern, on ftrradio.com. And so she's got an interesting story. I won't read you any more about her bio, but we'll do that more on Monday. But she's going to be on. So I know she's got a lot of interesting stuff. If you just even go look at her website, KathleenMcKinley.com, you see her writing some great articles on important issues of the day. So that's the plan. And then finally, I know that Dick is interested in this, as well as a lot of people in Central Florida. Dion Long is going to be on the 28th, on Thursday, the 28th of April. Dion Long, and we'll be talking about fair tax, gold standard, Federal Reserve. Dion knows this stuff inside out, and that's why I asked him to come on, because I think it's very relevant. When I spoke with Dion about a week ago and asked him to come on the show, I said, I think this is really relevant right now, given the current economic situation, what the government's asking from us and wants to do. And he agreed that it's very relevant right now. So that'll be a good show on the 28th of April. All right. So let's talk about some stuff that's going on today. I'm going to bring Dick on here, and we'll say hello to him. Dick, how you doing today, sir?
I'm doing good, Tom. Good afternoon, and hello to you, Paula.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
And now, how's your wife, Ann, doing?
She's doing good. I'm staying out of her hair, and I'm putzing around. You know I've got an old 58 Oldsmobile, Tom.
Yes, that's correct.
I had a car fire in it, electrical fire, not too long ago. And we just got done putting the car back together today, and it's gonna run again.
All right. Yeah, you got two beautiful classic cars there. Those are nice. So, well, good. I'm glad you're getting that. I remember when you told me about having the fire, the electrical fire, and so I guess you're just getting the parts finally in and getting that all together. That's great. Well, we'll have to go for a spin one of these days, and we'll go cruise on what's the best street to cruise on up there in New Smyrna?
Probably Canal Street.
That's right, Canal Street. Yeah, we'll go cruise Canal Street, especially on like maybe a Friday or Saturday night. That'll be fun.
I would love to get you and your wife up here on the first Saturday of the month when we have our car shows there on Canal Street.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I think you would both love it.
Yeah, that may be a possibility next month, so we'll talk some more about that. But I've got a whole bunch of things lined up here for us to talk about on, you know, what's going on in current events. And one of the first things I was looking at in the news, and this was yesterday that I was looking at it in the news, but I saved it because we see these things in the news. We see our political leaders, our elected representatives talking about these things. And this headline caught my eye. It said, Obama says spending cuts could trigger a second recession. And I had to laugh. Paula, you remember when we did an entire show on the Great Depression?
Yes.
And didn't one of the things that we learned as we stepped through the maneuvering and the moves that were made within the government, decisions that were made, particularly under the leadership of President Roosevelt, that spending cuts was not something he did. Spending was something he did, and raising taxes was something he did, and putting price controls on many goods and services across the country. And the assessment today is, looking back on that, that all it did was exacerbate the Depression, and as the author of that book we were reading from told us, FDR created a recession, a depression within a depression. So I think it's really sad, quite honestly, sad and disappointing, very, very disappointing, that we have a president who doesn't want to cut government spending and tells us it could trigger a second recession, when in fact we know throughout history that does not trigger a recession or even a depression. Not cutting spending from the federal government, not reducing costs, not reducing the debt is precisely what will keep us in this recession. So I didn't really want to go too much into that article, but I just think, boy, thinking back to that show we did and as we stepped through and looked at all the mistakes that were made in the Depression, we've got a president that wants to make all those same mistakes again. It's ridiculous. So I don't know if you'd seen that headline or not yourself, Paula, and what you thought of it.
I took a look at it. It's not something that I'm too happy with, but that would be most of the country is not happy with it as well.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that we've heard people use as a reference is, and I'm just going to read it to you, this is from the president, if all we're doing is spending cuts and we're not discriminating about it, if we are using a machete instead of a scalpel and we are cutting out things that create jobs, now that's a joke. There is nothing in the government that creates jobs. Not a thing today. Zero. Zip. But if we are cutting out things that create jobs, then the deficit could actually get worse because we would slip back into another recession. This notion that putting money back into the private sector, not government putting it, but leaving it there, somehow is going to create a recession is just absolutely ridiculous. And when he says a machete instead of a scalpel, I don't believe we need a machete. I believe we need a chainsaw. We've got this huge monster bearing down on us. A scalpel is ridiculous. We need a chainsaw. Start cutting off all those octopus kind of limbs, et cetera, and everything else. This is a joke. So that caught my eye. And then now here's one of the things that I do frequently, and I know people get tired of it, but I just can't help it because the president just opened himself up to this. I'm going to read a definition here first, and I'm going to ask you, Dick, to tell me if you've ever heard of this definition before. But it's called self-serving bias. The definition of self-serving bias is people attribute their successes to internal or personal factors, but attribute their failures to someone else or situational factors beyond their control. Have you ever heard that term before?
Yes, I have. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now that I've read you that definition of self-serving bias, I'm going to read you a headline. Obama blames speculators for rising oil prices. Now, what is it that speculators base their speculation on? Maybe our government policy on energy? He's trying to say that, well, there's unrest and problems in the Middle East, and so speculators are capitalizing on that. If, and now this is a question for Paula, if our energy policy was such that we weren't dependent on foreign oil, particularly in the Middle East, would speculators be able to cause prices to rise for us because of unrest in the Middle East when we have nothing to do with the oil in the Middle East?
I don't believe so, but I think
you keep going, please.
No, I don't believe so. I mean, that was that was a question that I, unfortunately, I had to put thought into. But if we had our, if we would tap into what we had here off the coast of our country, then we wouldn't have to be bothered with anybody else's stuff from another country. We would, you know, we've got, we could drill in Montana. We could drill off the coast. We could probably drill in Alaska.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
Can I jump in
well,
here?
Yes,
go right ahead, Dick.
This is a sore spot with me, and I've got all the proof in the world anybody could ever want. We could stop importing oil tomorrow. Stop completely.
Yeah.
All the wells we have drilled, and not just in the Gulf, I'm talking wells on dry land, that we are not taking oil out of that our government shut down. Open them up, start pumping oil.
Yep.
Take all of our unemployed, or a great majority of unemployed, and start building refineries. Build the refineries, work on them 24 hours a day until they are up and working and can refine the oil. And in the meantime, start drilling in our country. We don't need imported oil. We have all the oil in this country we need.
Yeah. You know, no, I agree with you. Now, one of the things in the article, here's the president saying, we're going to be monitoring gas stations to make sure there isn't any price. He's got his administration monitoring gas stations. There are bigger things to be doing in this world and in this country than monitoring gas stations for price gouging. My gosh, how many tens of thousands of gas stations are there across the country? And I know in the town that I live in, there's a lot of competition. Nobody can price gouge without all colluding with all the other gas stations. It isn't going to happen. So here's a diversion. Here's the president throwing something out that's just a bunch of baloney, has nothing to do with the problem. And finally, he follows up with this by saying that, the article says that the president was unable to pass a comprehensive bill to revamp energy policy and fight climate change in his first 2 years, but it's a priority for his second term. Yeah. So, first of all, he made it a priority to fight climate change, not to and that was the revamping of his energy policy, was to fight a ghost, climate change. He had no intention whatsoever of ensuring the security of the existing energy that we have in the United States of America, and even pushing for new and innovative energy sources. I'm all for that stuff. But what has he done? He's pushed for more ethanol. And I've got a lady out in California who knows the agriculture business inside out, and we're going to have her on the show. And for the life of me, I can't remember her name, and that's terrible. Hopefully she's not listening, but she knows who she is, and we've spoken. It's been a while since I've spoken with her, but she explained to me the conglomerates that own corn in our country. It's one major company that handles that. And all it does is hurt our agriculture business to push ethanol further. And here's the bottom line. I've looked at the numbers, the EPA numbers. Ethanol pollutes more than gasoline. So why are we pushing, if he cares about saving the planet and fighting climate change, why are we pushing ethanol, something that pollutes more than gasoline and takes a lot more resources to produce and a lot more money to produce than just our own gasoline? So this has nothing to do. He says one thing, but he intends something else. And what he intends to do is shut down the energy sector in our nations in the name of climate change. And I'm all for less pollution, and I'm all for new sources of energy. But he has no real plan. He has no plan whatsoever. He's focused on stopping coal, stopping gasoline, stopping the use of, putting smart monitors on homes to keep our energy uses down, and on and on. He's the president of no. But what are the solutions? We don't get anything. He talks in platitudes continually, and we get no actual solutions. And now that we're talking a little bit about energy, I know this is your area of expertise, Paula. I mean, what do you think about a guy who was so focused on saving the planet from climate change, and here's all of the things we're going to shut down, but then comes out with no real solutions for improving? This should not just be about saving the planet. This should be about improving our lives and our lifestyles and our the quality of living in the United States of America. He wasn't focused on that whatsoever. So go ahead, Paula.
No, in his defense, it's like anything else. Everybody promises something when they want to get into office, and his attention seems to have been refocused elsewhere. That being said, it just came up on the Hill that the Justice Department is going to look for market fraud affecting gas prices. Obama said that the Justice Department will launch a new effort to probe oil markets for abuses that might be driving up gasoline prices. You know, the new effort stems from last month's request from the Attorney General probe any potential price gouging. You know, the oil and the gasoline prices rising alongside turmoil in North Africa and the Middle East. The average price per gallon is $3.84 a gallon nationwide, compared to $3.55 a month ago and $2.86 the same time last year. You know,
well,
can I
ask a silly question?
Sure.
Go ahead.
There was a man that ran for president and made it. And in part of his campaigning, he said gasoline prices are necessarily going to rise, maybe up to $5 a gallon. And now all of a sudden he wants to look at price gouging? Is this the same man that we're talking about?
It is. You know?
Well, I think this investigation into price gouging is just a diversion from his failed energy policy. I'm telling you, I had been elected president, I would have instituted an energy policy right off the bat. It would have been a realistic, you know, smart energy policy that would have focused on, you know, solar. I'm not so hot on wind, but solar, hydro, as well as expanding the use of nuclear power. And I know nuclear power has a bad name right now, but when you have a nuclear plant in a place in the center of the United States of America that has no hurricane potential and no earthquake potential, then there's really virtually no danger. It's safer than any other form of energy production, and it's certainly a lot cleaner. But that's a small piece of it. And then focusing on and pushing for more natural gas use. You know, in Florida, you virtually can't find any place, at least in central and southern Florida that I'm aware of, where you can tell a builder, yeah, I want to have natural gas in my home, which, you know, growing up in whether it be Arizona or California, we had the ability to have, and we did have natural gas. Our, you know, water heater ran off of natural gas. You had gas stove. And we don't have that ability in a lot of parts of the U.S., and I think we should expand that because – now, here's a story about natural gas, and now you already know the answer, so it's not going to be any surprise. But John Stossel did a story once where he said he went to folks, and I don't mean to pick on ladies, Paula, but he said it was easiest when it came to the women to get this kind of an answer. He said, we've got a new energy source that is really clean and really abundant. The only problem is about – 100 people a year are going to die from this because it has sort of an insidious ability to be undetected if it gets loose or whatever. And do you think we should pursue this as a new energy type? And resoundingly, the women were like, no. 100 people a year are going to die? The reality is a few thousand people a year die from natural gas incidents. And yet here's an energy that we already had and we're using, but the majority of people, including men, said, no, it sounds too dangerous. We portray new possibilities as too dangerous if all we look at is what we're already using. They're significantly dangerous compared to some of the new possibilities out there. So we've got to broaden our horizons a little bit when it comes to energy, and I think natural gas is one that has got great potential, and even if on down the road, well, we have plenty to last us for centuries, but there is so much natural gas available down in South America that it's unbelievable, and they have nowhere to sell it. So even if we were to buy it from them, we'd buy it at a very cheap rate. And you've probably seen some of these cars that have done a natural gas conversion, Dick. I haven't seen any in a while, and I knew there were quite a few of them in California back in the 80s, but I was just talking to somebody yesterday about how it's very hard to find those conversion kits anymore, and I think part of it is because our modern-day cars are much more complicated. They don't use a simple carburetor anymore, and so converting a modern-day car to using natural gas, I guess, is much more expensive. Do you know anything about that?
Not what I do know is that the cars that the government is pushing, people are not buying them. The manufacturers have them on the showroom floor. People want the gas vehicles we've always used. Now, going back before your time, Tom, when I was a teeny bopper, we used to pull a little trick. You screw a spark plug into your tailpipe, run it to a hot wire, flip a switch, and you would shoot flames out the back of your car. Those flames were obviously unburned gasoline that was polluting the air.
Right.
You cannot do that today with a vehicle, even burning straight gasoline without using ethanol. It won't work. Cars have catalytic converters that burn everything up. Our cars today are cleaner than they've ever been. We are not polluting with our vehicles.
Yeah. Well, I know it's true. When I had auto shop class in high school, I remember the amount of fuel vapor that was unburned coming out of a typical engine back into the 70s, coming out the tailpipe, was something like, I think it was a ridiculous number. It was like 40% of the fuel vapor wasn't even being burned, and it was coming out the tailpipe. Today, I think that number is closer to about 20%. It's still a high number. The gasoline engine, and I have an engineering degree and took several thermodynamics classes, the gasoline engine is the least economic, least efficient, that's really the best way, the least efficient when it talks about power to fuel potential ratio, the least efficient of all known engines to mankind, even a big jet engine that you think is burning a lot of fuel, but it's getting a tremendous amount of power. And the gasoline engine is the most inefficient. And so back in college, I wrote an article.
Let me ask you a question, Tom.
Yeah.
This should be right along your line. A gasoline engine, the internal combustion engine, was not designed to run on gasoline. Gasoline does not burn. The fumes burn, which is why it is sprayed lightly into the cylinders to burn the fumes.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is a closed system with only the vapors going up to the engine. A tank of gas would last you probably 6 or 7 months just burning the fumes up. Am I right?
Well, I don't know. That I don't know about, but I do know a motor like a Stirling motor, instead of relying on combustion as a process, uses the heat generated from the fuel that you burn, so a Stirling motor can use anything that burns, which gives us a huge amount of flexibility. But that's never been pushed for automobiles. It's now really only in the marine bilge pump and a small generator industry, for marine products. But in a automobile, and NASA had one in a vehicle in the 80s, the early 80s, and it worked. It was amazing how fuel efficient it was and how clean burning it was. But and now I don't know if you have some thoughts on this, because you are the energy expert, Paula. What do you know about vehicle emissions and ethanol and any of that? Is there anything that you want to add to that?
I'm not, that's not really my specialty. I mean, I read a little bit about that. I did, while you were both talking, I did come across, there is someone in Chicago that actually sells the kits, these compressed natural
for the natural gas.
Yep.
Yeah. How much are they?
You know, he doesn't have a price list.
The gentleman I was speaking with yesterday said something like in the $5,000 range. That's I don't
are
know
we
if that's
talking
true or not,
natural
but,
gas or propane gas?
Well, it's LPG and CNG conversions.
Yeah, so that would be either or. You could use natural gas or propane.
Okay.
Which would
what
make sense.
What do you put the on a vehicle, what would you put in the vehicle to hold natural gas?
Well,
but natural gas flows through a pipeline.
Right, but under the floor, they've got a schematic on here, and it shows that there's an LPG tank that goes under the floor, and then there's the gasoline tank, and then there's the LPG gasoline switch. And then you've got a gas distributor, the pressure regulator, the LPG inspectors, and the engine control module in the front of the car. You've got four things in the front of the car. to me personally, I don't think I'd want to drive around with an LPG tank in my car.
Yeah. Well,
they go boom.
It could be an issue. Right. All right. Well, that's some of the interesting stuff, and I just thought it was sort of ridiculous that the president is well, this is typical of him. And I had to look that term up, self-serving bias, a couple years ago, because I started seeing the president acting that way, and a big part of it was, oh, it's Bush's fault. He just loves saying that. I mean, that's a recurrent theme. But I knew that there had to be a term for that, and I see that on a weekly basis from this guy. He's always got somebody to blame for things that aren't going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw him in a town hall, or a reporter asked him the other day, you know, what would you do differently? And he's like, you know, basically he doesn't think he's done anything wrong. He certainly doesn't want to admit it. But
well, he did have his teleprompter on.
Oh, yeah. Is that what it was?
Yeah, so he didn't know the answer.
Right, yeah, somebody turned it off, yeah. Well, now, speaking of energy, we know that General Electric and the CEO of General Electric, Mr. Immelt, has been real cozy with the president. And this gets into corporate welfare and what I call, and it's not just I call it, but I will, you know, generally refer to this as corporate cronyism. And so one of the things that, you know, I looked at was this article about Obama, General Electric, and corporate welfare. And it's interesting that this CEO has decided, and it's clear what GE has done. They've decided to get in line with the direction that this administration wants to take our free market, and particularly when it comes to energy and those kinds of things. So they're, you know, involved with wanting to, you know, get close with the government. And so Obama picks him to be his job creation czar and that sort of thing. And isn't it interesting that as we look at the numbers for this past year, GE's done pretty darn good in terms of making money and on and on. Well, here's the thing about a free market. And here, I'm just going to read from the article. Unfortunately, too many people think free market means pro-business. It doesn't. Free market means laissez-faire, prohibit, force, and fraud. But otherwise, leave the marketplace alone. In other words, get out. But the government never does that. When it says, oh, we have a free market, we do not have a free market. I work in an industry that is highly regulated, the airline industry. But remember, it's deregulated. No, it's deregulated so that we can now fail. But it's still highly regulated to control the industry and make most of its decisions for it. So here's what and let me tell you who put this article together. This is by John Stossel. So you know, I just mentioned him earlier. John Stossel came out back in March 23rd, and it was on Newsmax is where I got it. He said, left-wingers criticize corporate welfare until it's something they like, for example, green technology. And here's a quote from Tamara Drought of the progressive think tank Demos. The government's going to invest in certain companies to pioneer new technologies that I think is not corporate welfare. So I asked her, this is John Stossel saying, I asked her if business is too dumb to pioneer without government direction. Now here's the quote that really caught my eye. The private sector will only invest if they know for sure that there is a commercial marketplace. So what she's saying is it's up to the government to decide where the commercial marketplace is and then entice the private sector into it. Now, after I read that, I got my Constitution out, my pocket Constitution, and I don't see anywhere in the Constitution that it talks about the government playing a role in the economy other than, and we'll get to the Commerce Clause, but it doesn't. So I'm going to jump through the 18 enumerated powers of the Congress here real quickly, and this is going to be somewhat abridged. But please tell me, guys, if anywhere in here it says that it's the government job to ensure there's a commercial marketplace for things that the government wants so that the private sector will then get in, whereas the private sector isn't smart enough or can't determine that it's safe to get into a commercial marketplace, which usually is going to be true. But so here we go.
You're Congress going to raise my blood pressure.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dick, but they raise my blood pressure. Okay, number one enumerated power, they can tax us. Okay, is that taxing? No, that's creating a ensuring a commercial marketplace. Borrow money and credit? No, that doesn't fit it. To regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states. We'll come back to that because that's what they want to use. Oh, yeah, see, they get to do it. They get to create marketplaces because they are allowed to regulate commerce. We are going to come back to that. On to the rest. Establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws for bankruptcy. No, that doesn't apply. Coin money? Nope. Punishment for counterfeiting? Nope. Post offices and roads? Nope. To promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive rights. Okay, so in other words, saying, hey, you came up with a great invention. We want to use that in the government for a while. We want to take the rights of that for a while. No, nope, that's not it. Constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. Nope. Define and punish piracies. Nope. Declare war. Nope. Raise armies. Now, pretty much the rest of this is going to be about the military. Nope. Maintain a navy. Nope. Make rules for the government and regulation of land and naval forces. Nope. Provide for the calling forth of militia. Nope. Provide organizing, arming, discipline the militia. Nope. All right. Finally, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the District of Columbia. It doesn't say district, but that's what we're talking about, where the federal government is going to be located. Nope, that's not it. Then finally, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Okay, now that takes us back to the Commerce Clause. What is the definition of commerce? And I'm going to tell you, the definition of commerce is a monetary transaction. Now, it could be in the old barter days that we would trade corn for wheat. Okay, but in today's terms, commerce is a transaction. Dick, I want to buy one of your cars. Here's the money for that, and then you sell me the car. Is that interstate commerce? No. That's within the state commerce. But how about creating a commercial marketplace for example, green technology, something that the libs want? Now, I'm not opposed to green technology, but is it the government's place to get involved there? Well, they don't have the authority. Now, under the Commerce Clause, the libs will say, yes, they do. Commerce is a monetary transaction. It is not the goods and services that are involved in that transaction. It's only the transaction, and that is it. So we have a government that has decided anything and everything that touches a transaction can now be controlled. So let me give you a quick little example. Let's say, Paula, that I decide I'm going to go to the mall and purchase something. Now that I've made a decision to do that, although the transaction hasn't occurred yet, the government is saying, oh, fair game. Okay, you made the decision to do that. So on your way to the mall, we can regulate the car you drive, the kind of car you drive, the way you can drive it, the clothes you're wearing, the music you listen to. They want to regulate everything that has anything to do with that transaction. And that is not what the Commerce Clause says.
Don't you already think that they already have? They tell me that I have to put my seatbelt on when I get in my car, and I don't like to.
Well, they may or may not be using the Commerce Clause for that, but they are attempting to do that, particularly with the health care. But this is what this lady is saying here, that the federal government, you know, the private sector will only invest if they know for sure there is a commercial marketplace. So what we're saying is the government's going to guarantee a commercial marketplace. Well, where's that gotten us in trouble? How about the housing market and the banking industry when the government guarantees a commercial marketplace that's free from risk? This is ridiculous. This is what the liberals want. They want government to do everything for us, and then when government fails, sorry, well, then we'll fix it with something else, and we just keep on pressing forward, and we all pay the price. So that's the Commerce Clause. Now, let's just quickly, because I know people go like, well, Tom, that wasn't a good example. Let's take a look at health care. Okay, you and I have to have health care now under Obamacare because interstate commerce is involved in health care transactions, whether it's getting health care or insurance. And that's really where they're looking at is insurance. And my insurance company is out in California that provides my health care insurance. So what they're saying is the transaction – me paying them and them taking my money, it doesn't stop at that. It's now everything in the healthcare insurance industry. So let me give you an example. The federal government doesn't regulate the insurance industry, does it? But it wants to regulate the healthcare industry because, oh, it's just costing us so much. Well, let me digress for a second. I've really digressed already, but let me really now digress. You know, I think tickets at the movie theater are just getting too high. I want the federal government to step in and lower them. Because, you know, it's interstate commerce, and they have the right to regulate commerce. Why aren't they stepping in and mandating that all movie theaters can only charge $2.50 per ticket? How come they haven't done that for me? I want them to do that. Well, it's the same thing when you say, I want health care costs to go down. The reason they're up is because the government got involved to begin with Medicare. But, okay, we're not going to go there today. So how about life insurance industry? Why doesn't the federal government get involved in life insurance? Because, look, you know, if a family were to be counting on a particular spouse in that family as the bread earner, and that person were to pass away for any reason, accident, illness, whatever, boy, they could be in a real bind if they don't have a life insurance policy. I really think the federal government needs to step in and mandate that all people in the United States of America must have a life insurance and policy, life insurance policy, because it's interstate commerce. If you die, interstate commerce is affected, and, you know, there are different things that are going to be affected with that. Your family, for example, and everything that they're going to be purchasing, or they're going to be dependent on the state because you didn't leave enough money for them, et cetera, whatever the case may be. And, oh, by the way, we're not only going to mandate that you have to have life insurance, but we're going to tell life insurance companies you can't discriminate against smokers, drinkers, people that engage in risky activities like skydiving, et cetera. You can't take risk into account. You've got to insure everybody at the same rate. And, in fact, we want it to be a high rate. You've got to give everybody, we'll just say, $1 million life policy for $10 a month. Now, why hasn't the government gotten involved in that? Because they have no authority to get involved in that, and healthcare is no different. The Commerce Clause doesn't allow the government to get involved in all of the aspects of the manufacturing, production, and delivery of services that surround the service itself. So I'm going to read the Commerce Clause one more time, and I'm going to leave out the foreign nation spot. But it says, to regulate commerce among the several states. Among. What does the word among mean? The commerce that's going on between the states. The idea was to make sure that it stayed fair. And commerce is only a transaction. It is not the manufacturing process. It is not the services that are rendered for a monetary transaction. That is all that applies. So we need to redefine the Commerce Clause. I mean, it doesn't need to be redefined in my mind, but we've got to stop the government from taking the Commerce Clause and using it to control everything in our lives, because everything we do has some effect on interstate commerce. But that is not what the government is allowed to control. So we went through those quickly, the enumerations of power, and certainly the government creating safe commercial marketplaces is not one of them. But we've got our libs on the left wanting that. And as John Stossel says, when it's something they like, then they want government to intervene. When it's something they don't like, then, oh, no, you don't have the authority to do that. So I apologize. There's my rant on the Commerce Clause and Obama and General Electric. We can see that we've got a guy who, he was the president or chairman of the Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. This is corporate cronyism. If Obama wants somebody that's good at that and could help him out, he needs to look at somebody that's retired or somebody that leaves their post some big company like this. But to have GE CEO involved in this, I think, is self-serving for himself. And we all know it made the news just the other day that GE paid no corporate taxes whatsoever. Now, we're told by this administration we've got to spread the wealth, and we've all got to suffer a little bit. But President Obama's chairman of Jobs and Competitiveness, his company doesn't pay any corporate income taxes. Wow. And that's A-OK. See, if you're a friend of the president, you can get away with that stuff. But you and me, no, we have got to feel the pain a little bit more, because we just haven't been. And now, speaking of the pain, let's talk about some hypocrisy. I'm on a roll now. Let's talk about a little hypocrisy.
I know. I'm trying to get a word in edgewise, and I can't. You're covering too much territory.
I know. I get talking fast because there's just so much stuff. But I'll let you comment on this one, Dick. Obama is a hypocrite. We all know it.
No.
And this is an... This is an article written by Judson Phillips in the Tea
Been
Party
on
Nation.
His voice,
so yeah. Obama's a hypocrite. Well, let's find out what his latest hypocritic move is. And we saw this in the news, but I didn't quite catch this, so I really appreciate Judson Phillips pointing this out. But, his tax return was released, and he made $1.7 million. And yet he only paid taxes on $1.34. So in other words, he paid $434,000 in taxes. I mean, most people say, boy, that's a lot of money. How can you expect anybody to pay more than that? But remember, he's rich and he can afford it, just as he says he can afford it. But Mr. Obama took $350,000 in deductions.
How do you do that?
Well,
how do you do that?
I mean, it's,
I don't know.
I
I'd like to find out.
It's jaw-dropping. He took $350,000 in deductions when he's telling us that we've got to pony up.
Yep.
If he were a true leader, he would not take any deductions. He'd say, I could take deductions, but we've got to spread the wealth, and I'm wealthy, and I can afford it. But he didn't do that. So he tells us the wealthy can afford it, and we've got to make them pay, but then he doesn't pay. Yeah, he certainly did pay almost $500,000, but he could have paid more. And, as he would say, he can afford it, but he didn't. So he's a – this is – well, I say this all the time, but this guy is one of the worst leaders I've ever seen in my life, ever. After 22 years in the military, of which I was a leader on day one, it doesn't make you a good leader, but I learned quickly, and I had some great examples and great leaders to follow as I went through my career. This is some of the worst stuff I've ever seen. This guy couldn't lead a Cub Scout pack, and it's just a disgrace to this nation. I'm embarrassed, and we need to get rid of him as fast as we can. All right, so what say you, Dick?
We've touched a little bit on energy and conserving and stuff. Before I scare you and Paula half to death, these new fluorescent light bulbs that they have for the lamps, the little round ones,
yeah,
right,
that they save us all this energy. They take less electricity than a regular bulb. What is your take on those?
This is ridiculous. First of all, they're dangerous because have you seen the procedures you've got to go through to clean them up? It's a whole hazmat procedure. I mean, you might as well call the fire department and call out the
I guess I can't scare you
National Guard.
Because you know about them.
I
can attest to that because my husband recently took out some of those from an establishment here in town. And they had what they took out had to go into sealed, big sealed bags and sent somewhere that takes those bulbs. He couldn't just put them in the trash.
No, you can't. Do you know what you have to do? Let's say you have one in your house, and it slips out of your, it burned out, it slips out of your hand, falls on the floor, on your carpeting, and breaks. What do you have to do?
Get out of the house and run. No. No. No.
Basically, Paula, you're close. Because of the mercury contained within the bulbs,
they're still lead paint in the old houses, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Hey,
well,
because of the mercury
in these bulbs, you have to take the carpeting out of your house, destroy it, and put in new carpeting. It's contaminated, yep, and you can't clean it.
Man,
yeah, they're going to find that out how.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you this. When you can't get the regular light bulbs anymore, you still can. It's called drive across the border to Canada, or in my case, where I fly all over South America, I'll just buy a couple light bulbs at the hardware store. In fact, the grocery store I walk out to in Sao Paulo here, there's a hardware store right a block away from it. I can get all the light bulbs I need there and bring them back home, and I won't use those light bulbs. That's ridiculous.
Really?
Okay, you two are going to laugh at me. But I went through my house, and I looked at the wattage on all of the bulbs we're using, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I will have light bulbs that will last me the rest of my life. I will never have to buy one of those fluorescent bulbs. I went shopping.
Yeah, good. Well, I was restoring a house in New Hampshire there back when I used to fly out of Boston. And just before we sold it, and we were doing a lot of scraping of paint on the exterior of the house and then repainting. And a piece of this paint, a flake of it, I had a cast on my hand at the time because I had broken my hand, and I won't tell you how I did that. That's a whole other story. But I had broken part of my hand, and so I had this cast on. And when it came time to go get the cast off, they took an x-ray first just to double check, make sure things were, went and took the cast off. And there was this dark, dark thing that showed up through the x-ray. And the doctor's like, what is that? And as we took the cast off, there was one of these big flakes of paint on my hand that had gotten up under somehow under the cast and pretty far back in the cast. And it was lead paint.
And it contained lead.
So,
yep.
Yeah, it was lead paint, and that's why it casts such a dark shadow on the Hey, I know you guys are tired of the Commerce Clause, but this is hilarious, and I know it was not in the news, and I did pull this up, and I forgot to bring this in because I got on such a rant there, but did you know that federal judge, D.C. Circuit Court, or D.C. District Court, Gladys Kessler, you're a nut job. Okay, Gladys, she ruled that the Commerce Clause extends to regulating mental activity. She ruled that Obamacare, she was ruling on Obamacare being, you know, constitutional, that, let me just read it here. The good judge made the leap from physical activity to mental activity in extending the reach of the federal government. Now, here's the thing, and her reason was this. If you make a decision either to get health care health insurance, or not get it, you've made a decision, and that is an action, and because it affects commerce, the federal government can regulate it. So we're back to what I was saying before. The Constitution doesn't say anything that affects commerce can be regulated by. It says the commerce itself, and commerce is a transaction. People think commerce is, you know, all the goods. Like if I truck a whole bunch of TVs from Arizona to New Mexico and sell them there, that the commerce are those TVs and the truck I'm driving and the gas I'm putting in. No, it's when the store in New Mexico hands me the money for the TVs. That's the commerce right there. The exchange of money from one hand to the next. That's commerce. It's not the TVs. It's not the process that got them there. It wasn't the manufacturing process. But now she's saying because your decisions may affect commerce, a transaction of money taking place, the federal government can now control your thoughts. What a nut job. I mean, I've never heard of such a ludicrous thing. That's why you didn't see it much in the news, because it's so ludicrous and ridiculous. But this is a Clinton appointee district judge. You know, we need term limits for our federally appointed judges, including our Supreme Court. And that was something that Thomas Jefferson later in life said, recommended. He could have done something about it during his administration, but he felt it was risky. You know, we had states back then and people that were just looking for a reason to secede. You had Aaron Burr, who was vice president the first term of Thomas Jefferson, that put together an entire conspiracy initially to help the northern states secede. Then later on, it was going to be the Louisiana territories. And then you've got the guys like Alexander Hamilton that was interested in doing the same thing. And Andrew Jackson, good old Andrew Jackson, helped out Aaron Burr when he was putting together his conspiracy to break off the Louisiana territories. He got help from Andrew Jackson to do that. There was a lot of desire to split up the Union back then, and so I can understand why Jefferson hesitated on going after the Supreme Court, but we could really use that day. Term limits, not only, and we talk a lot about in Congress, but we also need it at the federal court level, because we get nut jobs like this, Gladys Kessler ruling that the federal government has the authority to regulate your thoughts, because your thoughts may affect commerce. Holy shmoly, I've never heard of such a ridiculous thing. So the Commerce Clause, and I know I beat that one to death today. Anything else that you saw today, Paula, of interest in the news?
Well, have either of you heard about the big news on the economic front that the Federal Reserve has decided to launch a second round of quantitative easing dubbed QE2?
Yeah, oh, I've heard about that. They're supposed to end what they've been doing right now in June, but they're so afraid, and I'll tell you why it'll happen. If they extend another round of that, it's because the president knows the effect that this quantitative easing is going to have on inflation and interest rates, and he wants to hold out for as long as possible before that stuff goes wild. But that's my take on it. But go ahead. What did you see
right
about it, Paula?
Well, something else came across the news today that they're saying, you know, I watch Squawk Box, as you know, and they've been talking about it, and they say that the warning signs are clear as day that we're on a collision course with the worst bond market collapse in decades.
Yeah.
And they say that there are three key factors that will cause the coming collapse. They're easy to spot. And it all has to do with the monetary policy, I guess, and inflation conflagration. Something else had come up that I had seen today on moneyusnews.com. Experts expect the Fed to finish the program in which it pledged to buy $600 billion worth of Treasury bonds to keep interest rates low and help spur lending and economic growth. There's been speculation about what will happen in the markets when the Feds end it and the economy is left to stand on its own without any stimulus.
Tom and Paula, I have to run. It's been great talking to you today.
Same here, Dick.
Hey, Dick, thanks for joining us. Call in any time. Say hello to Ann for us, and you have a great rest of the week and weekend. All right, take care, my friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The proponents are saying that the economy is better off because of the program, while inflation hawks say it has propped up asset prices across the board, and that they caution the markets are in for a reckoning after the Fed programs wind down. From what I'm hearing, it's not going to be a really good thing when it does occur.
No, it's not. Now, I did send you an article, The Setup for the Con of the Decade, written by Charles Hugh Smith. And anybody out there that wants to look at that, you can go to charleshughsmith.blogspot.com. Charles Hugh Smith, I'll spell it out. Charles, normal way to spell it, H-U-G-H, then S-M-I-T-H. And he's talking about exactly what we're seeing happening and the concerns that you voiced, Paula. He says, here's how the Fed and the elites are going to make money off of us, essentially collapse of the bond market, and then, and I'm no expert on this, but, you know, they've sold off bonds, now they're going to buy back bonds, and then when the bonds rebound eventually because they're going to be bailed out by the taxpayer, who's going to benefit from all of this? And so he lays it out. It's a little bit technical, but it's, I think, the worst-case scenario, but it certainly has a potential to happen. It certainly could happen, and it would be – well, he calls it the con of the decade. We'll figure it out when it's all over. We'll know when it's all over, and if the media will actually run that story about what the Fed has done with the monetary policy and the bond market, then we will all know that we've all been taken for a ride, and we have funded all of this mess from the beginning. We bailed out the banks and the financial sector, and then we're going to bail out the bond market, and then the Fed's going to walk away with all this money that they made. And who is the Fed? It's not the federal government. It's, you know, the elites around the world that have money in the Federal Reserve, or supposed. I think there's nothing there. I think it's all a big scam to begin with. But in any case,
well,
does that make sense?
It does, but, the, you know, Bernanke, he kept the interest rates virtually at zero for 30 months. So with the inflation is now showing signs of returning, but since November, Bernanke's been buying full two-thirds of the Treasury's debt in issuance, and he's not
right.
going to raise the interest rates, which means that the inflation
yeah.
will accelerate mostly through commodity prices. But when he stops buying the Treasuries, where does that leave the investors?
Well, that's exactly what this guy's article is pointing out, that the bonds are going to, you know, tank, and yeah, it's going to kill the investors, and that's why a lot of people, I'm trying to remember, PIMCO has gotten out of, I believe, bonds, and I don't remember if it's a particular sector of the bond market, but have gotten out of Treasury bonds. They've sold all their Treasury bonds because they see the tank coming, and so. Again, I'm no finance whiz, and I can probably find somebody. I do know some people that are like that to come on and talk about this kind of a thing. But I think things are going to potentially get ugly. I hope not, but they have the potential. And, again, our president will blame somebody else.
Yep, yeah. Exactly.
It's going to fall on our shoulders, but we're going to get blamed. And you know, I've got two quotes here I want to get in that I forgot about because I had them on another page. Thomas Paine, if there must be trouble, let it be in my day that my child may have peace. We've got an entire government, and I'm pointing the finger at everybody now. I know I pointed the finger at the president a lot today, but I'm pointing at everybody that just wants to pass this on to the next generation, that doesn't have the guts to do something serious about this. And you've heard me talk about how the size of the federal government, all discretionary, non-mandatory, all the departments eat up about $1.3 trillion a year. If we cut that to about $300 billion. And it's hard to imagine that the federal government can't run on $300 billion. And that doesn't touch Social Security, mandatory military spending, or Medicare and Medicaid. that's where the tough love ought to come, is the federal government. But the federal government, our leaders don't want to cut the size of the federal government. They want it to stay just as big as it is, and they just want us to pony up more money. Now, I think the tough love needs to come from the federal government. Cut it to $300 billion over the next 10 years, and you'll almost pay down the entire debt. Not deficit, which everybody keeps talking about, the deficit, which is the rate at which we're going into debt, but it will cut actual debt by $1 trillion every year. That's the kind of pain I can live with. If the Department of Interior has to go away, boo-hoo, it's not going to make a difference in my life. We already had a huge oil spill in the Gulf, which was a resultant of a massive failure of the Department of Interior to regulate that oil well. It had plenty of warning with over 700 violations from BP's oil well Deep Horizon, and yet it did nothing. So I could do a better job of monitoring those oil wells than our federal government is, and I would charge a whole lot less than the $15 billion a year that the Department of Interior charges us, the taxpayer. So I thought that was an interesting quote, going all the way back to Thomas Paine: if there must be trouble, let it be in my day that my child may have peace. And I say the same thing. We've got the trouble here. It's today. Let's fix it today and not pass it on to our children and grandchildren. And I think most Americans feel that way, but they don't realize – too many Americans don't realize what the federal government is doing, and that these talks about, well, gee, I don't know if I like the Democrat plan or the Republican plan. I don't like either plan. I mean, if I had to choose, yes, the Republican plan, because there are some cuts to the size of government, but it's minimal. It's minimal, and I don't like that. What they're relying heavily on are the reforms to Social Security and Medicare, which I also believe in, but why aren't people talking about the big, big cuts to the federal government? They're addicted. And I, you know, you've heard me say this many times, Paul, they're crack addicts. When it comes to the federal government, they're crack addicts. They can't let go of the spending and the size of the federal government. Both parties, they can't let go of it. They just have to have it. They're addicts. And I actually saw an article today where somebody called our government representatives addicts when it comes to and addicted to the size of the federal government. And that's exactly what it is. There's no other explanation that I can come up with. So I see that you you said that you are of Portuguese descent, and your grandmother was born in Brazil. Okay.
Yes.
And then what is the term for bread in Portuguese?
Pão. P-A-O. Pão.
P-A-O. Pão. Okay. Because it's interesting the similarities between Spanish and Portuguese, but the bread in Spanish is pan, P-A-N. And so I can walk around and see things and read and pretty much understand what they say. I certainly can't speak Portuguese, and I find that when I speak Spanish, they maybe understand me a little better than speaking English, but they still don't, you know, quite get it quite as well. But I think in some of these countries that I go to, when I used to actually lay over in Rio, we were at a different hotel than we are now, and when I'd sit out by the pool, there was one particular a waiter there that would come around and talk to me in Spanish, because he had been born and grew up in Argentina, but now he's living in Brazil, and he spoke Portuguese as well, but he liked the opportunity to speak with somebody in Spanish that he didn't get that often, and so that was, you know, kind of fun to do. But it seems like these days, compared to the old days, I spend more time in Brazil than I do in Spanish-speaking countries. I'm going to try and fly to Madrid this summer, and see if I can work that out. I did a couple summers ago, so we'll see if I can get those trips. But I would like to do that so I can get back to speaking Spanish again, instead of looking like a dumb tourist American who can't speak Portuguese in Brazil. But that's another story. Well, what else do you have, Paul? Anything else for
I had
breaking news
this,
today?
Yeah, well, I had noticed this article that you sent me. I read the Boston Herald from time to time on the state funded website that you
just
sent me. Critics blast state funded sex ed website.
Right. Yeah, I really find it despicable that the way they put that site together, where they talk about for young people, how to get an abortion, and it's really not that hard. And, you know, I understand giving people all the information that's available out there, but we're talking about kids that are still minors and under the control of their parents and under the guidance of their parents. And I guess the worst part about it is it's it's state funded. Now, I'm a huge proponent of state rights, and I believe that the states have a lot more leeway in things they can do in terms of being a government. At the same time, in my state, I don't want my state government using my state taxes to pay for things like this. And that's just, I don't think it's appropriate at all. But I saw that, and I saw that it was, you know, in right there in Massachusetts and Boston and right in your backyard. So that's why I kind of jumped on that. Not that I thought it was a real huge or important topic. I mean, it's certainly important if you live in that area and, you know, your kids are going onto this website to see how they can get away with stuff. But I knew that it was right in your backyard, so I just wanted to see what your opinion on that was.
Yeah, and you understood what I had meant. I just think that, you know, taxpayer money would be better spent on other things as opposed to that. But, you know, me being a resident of the Commonwealth, we have the moniker that we're known as Taxachusetts, you know. And over the years, there have been rushes of people just leaving the Commonwealth, whether they're going up north to live in New Hampshire or they're going down south to live in Maryland, South Carolina, or Virginia because the way of life is so much better there. It's sad. And, I mean, even losing the businesses that we've lost over the years, most recently we've lost Evergreen Solar after the Commonwealth had plunked millions of dollars into that company, and we lost Fidelity. You know, hundreds of jobs have been lost because these two companies had come in, you know, when they did, and then decided to pull up roots and go. There's
right.
No justification in the stuff that gets done here in this state.
Yeah. I saw the same kind of problems out in California when I lived out there while I was in the Navy. And, you know, this is why I'd like to see more of the social and civil issues that we do confront today as Americans reside in with the states and not the federal government take them on, because we have a much better chance, a much better shot at resolving them at the state level than we do at the federal level. We think the federal government can do anything and everything for us. The problem is, if we don't like what they're doing, then we end up with this process where you got, you know, majority of states opposing Obamacare and on and on and on. If this were a health plan at the state level, then all you've got to do is work with your state legislators and come up with a, you know, compromise or a solution. And if you don't like where they're going, you get rid of them and hire new legislators. And I've seen that happen in various states where the legislators just aren't listening to people. Boom, you're out. We put somebody in who will, and then they get it done. At the federal level, it's so much harder to get that stuff done. It's just so much harder to get social and civil issues done. And that was never the purpose of the federal government, to handle those things. And you've heard me read this before, but I just have to do it. We'll kind of wrap things up. I think James Madison, one of my heroes, I love the stuff that he wrote, especially leading up to the Constitution that we have and the way that he wrote the Constitution. But he said, so anybody wants to argue about, well, the Constitution's a living, breathing document. No, that's an absolute lie, and we've talked about that before. I'm not going to go into it again. But the gentleman whose version of the Constitution was adopted by the Constitutional Convention, the Constitutional Congress, the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Boy, that doesn't sound like today, does it? Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. I mean, we're upside down on this. Right now, it appears that the federal government has numerous and indefinite powers, and it's the federal government and the states that have few and defined. The former will be exercised principally on external objects as war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. The powers reserved to the several states will extend to, and here's the key, all objects which in the ordinary course of affairs concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people and the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. Social and civil issues not meant to be handled at the federal level, because the federal government was never designed to handle them, so they will not handle them well. So that's my rant, my final rant coming from James Madison, who wrote some great stuff, and Jefferson reiterated these things over the years as well about the role of the federal government. And here's, you know, one of his. I'll read a Jefferson quote since we're talking quotes today. The best general key for the solution of questions of power between our governments, and he's talking between the federal and the state, is the fact that every foreign and federal power is given to the federal government, and to the states every purely domestic. Wow. healthcare sounds like a domestic issue, doesn't it? So I don't know why we've ended up. Well, I do know why, because Ben Franklin warned us that over time the states would gradually give up sovereignty. And the way he said it was, the natural inclination of mankind is a kingly government. And that's where we're headed, a kingly government.
Right.
So we did get a caller here at the end of the show. I just kind of recognized that phone number.
It's Bobby from Los Angeles, and he's got a question for you on your interpretation of something. So.
Sure, absolutely. Wow.
Okay, that's not what he asked me when I screened his call.
That's okay. We can easily edit that out. See, this is, you know, for anybody that's listening, and anybody will catch this before we edit it out. And hopefully, what was his name again?
Bobby.
Yeah, hopefully Bobby is still listening, because Bobby's an idiot and a moron, and that's a typical – he's probably a liberal. And what they do is they call in to conservative shows like this, and they do that. They lie. See, what have I said all day long? We've got a president who's being deceptive and not telling us the truth. And so what liberals do is they lie. They lie to get past the call screener to get on and then ask stupid-ass questions. So that will be edited out easily later tonight.
I walked right into that one. Lesson learned.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know, me – I may be a retired fighter pilot, but I'm a nice guy. I'm a really nice guy, and I take probably a little too much than I should. See, a guy like that would never say that something to that to me in person like that, because he would have been intimidated. I could tell by the sound of his voice that he is a little bit of a wuss. So face-to-face, he never would have brought up a question like that, because he knew that I would have, you know, had to take necessary and proper action, according to the Constitution. So anyway, well, with that said, let's wrap up the show, and we'll do a little editing here in a few minutes, Paula. Thanks for being on the show again with me today. It was a pleasure, and we will be back tomorrow. I'll be broadcasting back in Florida, and we've got a great guest, Winston Scott, astronaut and Navy fighter pilot, so we don't want to miss that. Paula, have a great evening. Say hello to your family for me, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for coming on the air with me.
You're welcome.
Okay, good night.
Bye.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.